Morning. Well, you certainly drew a crowd today, didn't you? People must have read the briefs.
Good morning, Justices. I'm Edward McNally from the Morris James firm here on behalf of Reserves. Of course, had I known it was to be taped, I would have worn a mask, but in any event, I'm going to focus on just a few issues today. I am aware that the court has heard me on the facts of this case in the past, so I don't really think I need to go over them in great detail. I'm going to focus on the offset that the trial court took for the use of land to barter for services rendered, the offset that the trial court took for the lack of a geothermal system, the offset that the trial court took for a lack of pond liners, and then I will focus on the claim that the individuals should have been held personally liable for misrepresentation. As a general point, of course, this court, in reviewing a trial court's determination, must be satisfied that the trial court used an orderly and logical deductive process to reach the final result. If it's not orderly and logical, then the result of the trial court should be set aside. Here, I think there are three, or perhaps four, key facts that nobody disputes. Nobody really disputes at this point, after two contrary findings at the trial court of Chancery and the trial court Superior Court, that Crystal was obligated to pay 42.5% of the construction costs. Nobody can claim otherwise. Nobody disputes that a substantial amount of work, $2.5 million of work, was done and passed at least two inspections without any complaint, both by the bank who was lending the money and by the construction manager's firm. And, of course, no one can dispute that Crystal didn't pay a penny of its $1.2 million share of those costs. And the trial court basically agreed with all those facts, agreed with the amount of work that had been done, and proceeded to agree, I think, that Crystal would be liable for $1.2 million, but for some offsets. Now, the first offset rose out of a barter arrangement that Reserves entered into after Crystal didn't pay its share to trade lots at the Reserves for the work of the contractor who was doing the site improvement work. Now, under the course of the purchase and sale agreement, quote, Crystal shall pay within 10 days after being billed, therefore, its proportionate share of all costs, close quote. And as the applications for payment show, the work was done, and as I've said, it was inspected, and Crystal's obligation to pay was triggered. Now, why should the fact that Reserves used land to barter for services make any difference with respect to Crystal's obligation?
These are the lots that went to Fresh Cut.
Well, they actually went to Fresh Cut's president, Justice Holloway, but that's
correct. No, I understand that.
Yeah.
But, it was to be credited for the Fresh Cut work, and then there's a dispute about whether they should get credit because it didn't really go to Fresh Cut directly.
That's a dispute that's presently pending in the trustee for Fresh Cut.
Right.
The trustee agreed that $750,000 was borrowed by Glenn, transferred to Fresh Cut. The trial court in this case agreed with that. So there's still $750,000 that the trial court deducted, or at least gave a credit to Crystal for its proportionate share of the $750,000.
Back to our case, and your contention is and there shouldn't have been a $750,000 credit for these three lots that went to the president. Is that correct?
For these six lots that right. went to Glenn, let me put it, can I answer this question by an example? Because I've been thinking about how to explain this and make it a little bit simpler. If I was a general contractor and agreed to build a house for an owner of a lot, and the house cost $100,000, and I managed to barter the electrical work by telling the electrician that I'll give you a lot next door if you do the electrical work for free. Now, the owner, when the work is done in past inspection two times, presumably owes me the $100,000, and he doesn't get an offset because I paid for some of the work with a piece of real estate. He just doesn't get that offset. trial court here gave Crystal an offset, and it doesn't deserve it because that's just not logical. The dispute, if any, that exists over whether or not Freshcut was paid in full is a dispute between Freshcut and Reserves. It's going to be resolved in the bankruptcy court. It has nothing to do with Crystal's obligation to pay under the literal terms of its contract within 10 days for that work. So we argue that the trial court made an error in that respect.
So you want to add back in $750,000, is that right?
Yes. And it won't be added. Your Honor understands it's 42.5% of $750,000.
Exactly. But we add it in because you get no credit at all. I mean, you don't get the credit. And then if you don't get the credit, the share is 42%.
Correct. They don't get the credit. That's right.
So we would add 42% of $750,000 to the amount that was awarded to you on this first point.
That's correct, Justice Holland. And the trial court's opinion is very clear exactly what deduction it made in the opinion. You can look at what Judge Stokes' calculation. It's right there. Next, I'll turn to the geothermal system. As originally planned, Reserves was to have a central geothermal well system. And that system would be paid for on maintenance fees charged by the management company for the development. And it's the undisputed testimony of Mr. Karaki that he determined that it would be cheaper for each lot owner to have its own system. And there's no evidence, that this change from a central system to individual systems somehow devalued the lots sold to Bellavia. There's no expert testimony that the lots were worth less. There's no expert testimony that having a central system over the long run would cost less than having individual lot owners have a system. There's just simply no proof that this change costs Crystal or Bellavia anything. Nonetheless, the trial court accepted the offhanded testimony of one of the principals of Crystal that individual systems cost more to install than a central system, and therefore there was some reason for an offset. But that simply is not logically proof that the lots were worth less. There's just no proof. Finally, on this point of offsets, and there are a couple of other offsets that are talked about in the brief, which I would prefer to just rely on the briefs about. The other major offset has to do with this whole dispute over the lack of pond liners to the various water retention ponds that were installed at the reserves. Here again, I think a somewhat homespun example, to me at least, illustrates the point, which is that if my contractor, example, agrees to build a house and also to install a swimming pool, fails to install the swimming pool, he's still entitled under the contract to be paid for the house. Now, if it turns out that the landowner decides he still wants the pool, as long as he never pays the contractor for the pool, there's no deduction from the contract price. He can go out and get the pool from somebody else and use that money. Here, there's no dispute that Crystal didn't pay for pond liners. They didn't get pond liners. They didn't pay for them. So there's no logical reason to deduct that from the amount of damages to be the amount of their contractual obligation to pay for. Now, of course, there's also no dispute that the pond liner issue is sort of, in my view, at least a red herring, because everybody who testified at all, that the ponds work fine without them. Certainly, there's no reason to deduct $95,000 from the amount that Crystal was to pay for when Crystal never paid that money to begin with. Now, finally, I want to talk a little bit about the individual liability claims. The trial court dealt with one of the reasons why the individuals who are defendants in this case were claimed by Reserves to be liable to them, and that was that they didn't tell Reserves the truth when they said they had the financial means to carry out the project. Trial court made findings of fact on that point, and that point is not raised on this appeal. What the trial court did not deal with is the second contention by Reserves, which is that Mr. Esham, when he promised that he and his partners, would put up the money for the bonds and would otherwise perform in accordance with their contractual obligations so that Mr. Kiraki on behalf of reserves would post $2 million for a bond, would enter into $3 million in contracts, you'd have that backup that they simply were not telling the truth. And there's evidence of that. Now, when someone says that they have an intention about something in the future, it's always difficult to prove that that's a lie because they can always say they just changed their minds. But it's still possible to prove it's a lie, and you can do that in a couple of ways. One, if they write down on a piece of paper that what they've told the other side is subject to all sorts of conditions that they haven't revealed, that's evidence that they are not telling the truth. And, of course, that's exactly what happened here, because Mr. Esham wrote down on a piece of paper that he wasn't going to pay his fair share because he wanted to get $400,000 as an offset. Never shared that with the bank, never shared that with reserves. Secondly, when someone repudiates their promise immediately, that's evidence that the promise was not made in good faith, was not made truthfully. Secondly or thirdly, when someone repudiates their promise for no reason, that's evidence that what they said was not intended to be truthful. Here, we know that Mr. Esham didn't look at a single one of the 12 applications for payment that he received, refused to review them, said right after the reserves entered into the contracts, no money will flow. He didn't pay a penny to their contractual obligations. So his immediate repudiation of his promise after the contracts had been entered into, his complete failure to take any steps to carry out their promise, and his complete lack of any excuse is evidence that the trial court should have considered but did not in resolving the claim that Esham and the others lied. That claim, not having been resolved by the trial court, should be remanded to the trial court for a resolution. With that,
Could I just ask about that last point? When you got the trial court's decision and there didn't appear to be any discussion of the issues you've just raised, did you seek re-argument?
Re-argument was not sought by the reserves on that point. Re-argument was sought by that Crystal on other points, and the re-argument took place. When we got the trial court's decision, which of course was an oral decision on the bench, from the bench, or over the telephone, actually. I can't explain why we didn't seek a re-argument. We just didn't do it. I think at that point we wanted to get it over with and get, quite frankly, to take the appeal. You know, there's a problem, and it has to do with court reporting, and the poor trial court did not have a transcript because it didn't have a court reporter, and so it just seemed logical to go to the next step.
And what you're asking on that issue is for a remand, in essence?
Yes, Justice Berger.
So you're not, I guess, if I understand you correctly, you are not contesting the trial court's one finding of fact, which was that Esham or whoever actually had the wherewithal to enter into the agreement, but that you claim that there was evidence that could have supported a finding that there were other misrepresentations made and that the trial court didn't address those and that they were part of your case and therefore should be sent back to be decided.
Yes, Justice Berger. I could elaborate, but that's the simple answer. Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, before you sit down, I have a question about the palm liners. Tell me why that's different than if I contracted to build my home and have 5 inches of insulation, and I find out that the contractor put in 3, and the contractor's response is, but 3's enough. And I ask him the difference between putting in 5 and 3, and he gives me a number, and I say, aren't you going to give me a deduction because I only got 3? Am I wrong to say that the logic that you've expressed to us for the pond liners is the same, that there shouldn't be any offset for the pond liners because they weren't necessary, they weren't required by government regulation, and the ponds functioned properly without them?
No, the logic is not the same, Chief Justice.
Okay, tell me why it isn't, please.
Because in your example, the contractor is asking you to pay for something you didn't get, 5 inches of insulation. Here, nobody asked Crystal to pay for pond liners that they didn't get. And it's clear that the Orbeck Phoenix, who was the inspector on the job, understood that there were no pond liners. The engineer understood there were no pond liners. There's no testimony, not a bit of testimony, that Crystal was billed for pond liners. That simply didn't happen. In this contract, $300,000+ was retained, normal process to have retention. That was never paid over, and so the result is that Crystal hasn't paid.
Your point is they were never really asked to pay for something they didn't get.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Morning, Your Honor, Justices. Let me begin where Justice Berger kind of left off on the personal liability claim that had been raised. What Reserves argued below was that the members of Bella Via committed fraud by inducing Reserves to execute the purchase and sale agreement, and in doing so, or by doing so, that they misrepresented their own abilities to carry this project out.
All right, before you go any further, while I have a program and should be able to tell the players from the program, I've heard all about Crystal in the opening argument. Now you've introduced Bella Via. Though I think I have a memo that explains that to me, would you tell me who's who and who's
sure.
on first between Bella Via and Crystal?
Bella Via was the purchaser of 30 lots in the Reserve subdivision. They were a party. It was a party with Reserves Development for the construction of infrastructure for those 30 lots that Bella Via purchased, as well as 41 lots that Reserves retained in that particular phase of the subdivision. And when I say infrastructure, I'm referring to construction of roads, sewer and water, stormwater management, things of those things.
But what's their relationship to Crystal?
It's an entirely different entity from Crystal, although the members are identical. Crystal Properties, actually Crystal was the initial party to the 30-lot purchase and assigned its rights to Bella Via. Crystal also purchased Lot 6 and built a spec home or a resale home on that property. So that's a separate issue entirely, but they were both parties defendant in this action.
Okay.
The misrepresentation claim then was as to the members of Bella Via or Bella Via itself, and the claim that they did not have the financial wherewithal to carry out the project. Now, what they seem to be complaining about now is that Judge Stokes didn't go into all five elements of the misrepresentation claim, but what Judge Stokes did do was determine the very first one by saying that there was no misrepresentation, that the individuals and the company itself had the wherewithal to complete the project. And just from a practical standpoint, if you have to meet all five elements and you can't meet the first one, I'm not sure that there's any real necessity for the trial court to go on and determine the other four elements.
Well, if I understand opposing counsel, he's saying that one of the ways in which they intended to prove that there was fraud was to establish that the principals didn't have the wherewithal, the financial means, but that there were other facts upon which one could reach the conclusion that they were defrauded, having to do with whether they ever intended to carry out their obligations and that sort of thing. Why aren't those issues still needing to be resolved?
I'm not sure that those issues were necessarily raised below, Your Honor. And what I was just referring to when I represented what Reserves had represented was from their post-trial brief or post-trial memo to the court. That was really the only issue that was raised, that these guys never really had the ability to carry out this job from day one. And
well,
Judge Stokes,
why was Mr. McNally telling us about in this paper Esham signed with the note? I realize that's disputed in the briefs about what it means, but Mr. McNally suggests that this notation of $400,000 as a precondition to going forward indicates whether they had the money, it wasn't going to go forward unless there was a $400,000 credit. Therefore, from the beginning, there was no intention to really go forward since this undisclosed condition is now made known. You're saying that was never raised at the trial court?
There was testimony that touched on that. I don't at this point remember specifically what was asked and answered, but I don't think that Reserves fairly presented that to the trial court as the basis for the personal liability claim. You know, this was a count that was added to the complaint, I think maybe a month before trial. It had not been something that had been the focus of all the pretrial proceedings and pretrial discovery. And I think it was a late add-on, and the only thing really that Reserves focused on was that ability of the members and the company itself to make the job work, which Judge Stokes obviously did address in some detail with the amount of money that they had put into the project and the fact that he had reviewed the bank documents, presumably the loan applications and financial statements and so forth, and concluded at that point that the members and the company itself clearly had the ability to go forward. I think that was the only issue.
He was also influenced by the amount of money that was still in the escrow account, right?
There were a number of factors. There was roughly $1.5 million still in escrow toward construction. They had already dispersed $3 million from their mortgage to buy the property in the first place. They had been making their interest payments of roughly $24,000-$25,000 a month to the bank over the course of a couple of years that this matter has been pending. They'd made contributions, to the company when needed. So, and I think all of that combined led the court to conclude that they very obviously had the means to go forward.
Right. Well, let's leave that point subject to anyone else's questions and talk about the $750,000. Explain to us why that was a proper set-off.
At the trial, Reserves Counsel presented a stipulation which had apparently been entered into by the bankruptcy trustee and Reserves Counsel in the bankruptcy court, which acknowledged having received $750,000 in payment or in other values by way of the property. Each of the lots, of course, was valued at $250,000 in concept, at least, or in theory, which should have amounted to $1.5 million. But that stipulation seemed to suggest that the bankruptcy court was only recognizing that Freshcut had received half of that amount by way of the lot transfers. In their analysis to the Superior Court, Reserves wanted credit for $1.5 million, but that seemed to me that stipulation, I assume the court agreed with this, that stipulation limited the payment to $750,000.
And if so that's you're saying that the total bill for Fresh Cut was $1.5 million, and that if you multiplied 42% by $1.5 million, you'd get a number, but that the starting point wasn't $1.5 million; it was really $750,000 based on the stipulation.
I believe that's the way the court analyzed it. That's the way I understood it to work, and so. You know, if all that Reserves paid for was $750,000, they shouldn't be billing Bellavia for 42% of $1.5 million.
Right, so
they're getting the windfall at that point.
All right. Well, going back to the stipulation, then, is it your view that Freshcut billed $1.5 million, but was only paid $750,000? So Freshcut would still be owed $750,000.
That's the way I understood it, Your Honor, and I think. That's, of course, there's a new pleading now in the bankruptcy court that Reserves included in their last appendix, which seems to question whether or not Freshcut received anything. They seem to be questioning whether
right,
or not.
Because it went to the president.
Went to one of the president, one of the principals who may not have and apparently didn't get the money paid over to Freshcut.
But going back to our case in the Superior Court, Reserves said Freshcut bill was $1.5 million. Your share's 42% of $1.5 million. Your response was, well, no. According to the bankruptcy records, it was $750,000 that they were paid, no matter what they were billed. We owe you 42% of what you actually expended. And since if we give you credit for the $750,000 on the lot, you expended $750,000, and so therefore your claim for $1.5 million should only be for $750,000. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. I think that's the way the court interpreted it, because it Reserves was approaching it by starting with its $2.5 million number, the total that it claimed to have spent. And if we're basing the percentages on what's been spent or what's been paid by reserves in the first place, they shouldn't be passing along 42% of some number, $750,000, that they really didn't pay. There's the windfall in there then would have been, I know they wouldn't have considered it a windfall because they never got anything from Bellavia, but that I think was the analysis below.
Can I follow up on that, because I continue to be confused? There's no question about the number of lots. There were six lots, right, at $250,000 each?
That were transferred, yes, to the principal of Fresh Cuts.
Okay, and that's $1.5 million.
Correct.
Okay. And nobody, if I'm understanding it correctly, nobody has said, well, actually, you mispriced those lots. They were actually only worth $125,000 each. So the value that you assigned to them was incorrect. That's not an issue, is it?
It has not been before. I think the agreement always was that each lot was to represent $250,000. I don't think anyone now that may be part of the current bankruptcy action. But
okay, but what I'm getting at is that if I pay for something in land instead of in cash, and a value is given to that payment, and then somebody says, well, wait a second, that land wasn't really worth what you said it was, then that would obviously adjust how much credit I should get for what I paid out in land. But that is not the issue,
I don't believe that has ever been the issue, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. So we've got a payment of by reserves of $1.5 million worth of land to Mr. Glenn, is it, or whatever?
Glenn, right.
And now there's a dispute because Mr. Glenn didn't actually pay over $1.5 million to Fresh Cut. Instead, he only paid Fresh Cut $750,000. Is that correct so far?
That is what I think the stipulation said that was admitted at Superior Court level.
Okay. And what I'm having trouble understanding is why isn't that a fight between Fresh Cut and Mr. Glenn, because he didn't pay over what he was supposed to pay over, as opposed to it being a set off against reserves, who everybody agrees paid six lots of land worth $1.5 million. But I don't understand why that should make a difference.
Well, I think that gets back to the procedure that was chosen itself. I mean, why in the world was reserves paying these deeds or transferring these deeds to someone other than Fresh Cut? If they owed, if reserves was being billed by Fresh Cut, and I'm saying this rhetorically, obviously, why were the deeds not being transferred directly to Fresh Cut, where somebody could document that dollar for dollar or dollar for value payment? Why in the world are they conveying them to this third person and then relying upon that individual's promise to eventually pay the money over to Fresh Cut? I think that was the problem that the Superior Court had. I know it was the problem that the Chancery Court had, and I think you remember parts of that case from the last one.
But okay, so what happens now? The trial court said, I'm only giving you a credit for $750,000 because that's all that's been agreed to that as to what Fresh Cut received. But there's still a fight, if I'm understanding it, between Fresh Cuts and Mr. Glenn over another $750,000 worth of land that wasn't translated into cash and put into Fresh Cut, right?
That's what I understand to be the current bankruptcy
what,
status.
What happens if, when that all gets resolved, Fresh Cut winds up with another $750,000. Where does that leave this issue between these parties?
Well, to the extent that there's any relationship left, I guess at that point they would be free to bill Bellavia for an additional 42% of $750,000. I don't know that there's any other way to approach it at this juncture. I mean, from our standpoint, at least.
But let's go back to the beginning. If they transferred $1.5 million in lots, why don't they get credit for paying $1.5 million to Fresh Cut? Whether Fresh Cut ever got the lots, as Justice Berger said, seems to be secondary if their intent in transferring $1.5 million in lots was to pay Fresh Cut.
But I think at that point we get back to the process itself and who are you going to look at and point the finger at for the fact that this did not proceed the way it was supposed to. And I think that falls on Reserve's shoulder because Bella Via had absolutely nothing to do with this process.
I know, but so I guess then what the question is, why 750 rather than 1.5? And your answer to that is the stipulation in the bankruptcy court.
Well, I think that's part of it, and certainly that has to be a major part because it was introduced and relied upon by Reserves below. But I think we also looked at, and we spent a lot of time on the briefs in the process itself and the same rhetorical questions I was saying was just using, I think have some real merit. Why in the world are they paying somebody else? If you'd have given the deeds directly to Fresh Cut, we wouldn't be having this argument. It's who to put the blame on, I suppose.
You're into your near the end of your time. I had a question about lot number 6. I just want to see if I understand the facts. And my understanding is at one time when this was a large piece of property owned by Bennett, if someone did a title search, they would have found a recorded easement on the Bennett property. Then it was subdivided into lots, and if we superimposed the subdivision on what I'm calling the Bennett property, we would find below lot number 6 this previously recorded easement. Is that right so far?
I want to make sure I understand your question correctly, that there was an old farm road of sorts that ran from Woodland Avenue across a one or two pieces of farmland to what is now the Reserves, and it seems to enter, exit, whichever way you're moving, at about lot 6.
All right, but that was recorded for someone to find.
That was on record, that's correct.
And the dispute seems to be whether that prior recorded easement continued after the property was designated as lots because this particular road went over lot number 6. Is that right?
That's correct.
My question for you is, how was it extinguished?
It was extinguished when Reserves purchased, subdivided whatever parcel the current subdivision is on. It doesn't extinguish the road from Woodland to Reserves. It extinguishes it from that point on because at that from that point through Reserves, because Reserves didn't need an easement over its own property.
Well, that's true, but you can't extinguish an existing right of way by simply saying I'm turning it into a lot. I mean, you normally get all parties in interest to relinquish their right to use it or whatever, but my question is, how was it extinguished other than it was unnecessary?
Well, I think that's where the merger doctrine figures in, that once the property owner owns the dominant and the servient portions of an easement, the easement by law disappears. So although the right still exists for Reserves to utilize that old farm road, which is really what that Smith case was all about, it doesn't bind the owners of Lot 6, who subsequently purchased without any notice of how that was going to be used by Reserves. I mean, there's nothing out there that would alert a third purchaser. Now, obviously, there's some complications because Crystal actually used the easement itself or the entrance when it built its own house. But Joe Smith, the third party who wants to buy that property, is not going to find anything which would alert him to the fact that there are going to be dump trucks and tractors coming in his backyard.
No, but based on what you said, it would be just the opposite. The person doing the title search would find the road, and the question would be, oh, my goodness, what are we going to do about this road across Lot 6? And you're saying the legal answer is don't worry about it because the person who now owns it is the same person who had the right-of-way, and they've merged, so your concern is really misplaced because it's legally been extinguished.
I think that's part of it, and again, when Reserve subdivides the property, They have all these nice lots and roads and so forth, and there's nothing on that plot that shows that the easement is going to continue on the lot 6 or any other lot for that matter. And it'd be like if they decided at this point that, you know, lot 22 was a better site for a stormwater management pond, and they decided they would go ahead and do it. That seemed to be the logic of what Mr. Kuratke was testifying to below, that he really had this uniform or universal right to do anything to these properties that he wished. But when you develop the subdivision itself, and I think I'm hitting on the Rago and Judge cases, although I don't know which one is which at this point, but there was a statement in one of those cases that the buyer of a lot in a recorded subdivision like that has every right to rely on what's on those plots. And there was absolutely nothing in that plot that would alert a purchaser that Lot 5 was going to be subject to a perpetual easement to run tractors and bobcats through.
Thank you very much.
I think I'm over. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Holland, Vice Chancellor Strine recently decided a case, it's in the, referred to in the briefs, on August 12th, and called Smith versus Reserves, in which he extensively gets into this whole easement question, finds that there was an easement across the Smith land, and he goes into the rest of that issue. Certainly he didn't find that there was an easement to nowhere. I mean, he understood that there was an easement across. I had a feeling, Justices, that we were going to get hung up on this stipulation. It's in the record. I have three copies. May I hand it to Your Honors just to make it simple? I'll be very quick.
Thank you, Mr. Burrell. There's no problem with that.
I think it was in the record.
Oh, it's definitely in the record. Oh, yeah.
Well, it would be handy for us to have it for our discussion.
Yes,
Your Honors, I would call your attention to the bottom of page 2, where it explains what's going on here a little bit. And it says at the bottom of page 2, and it gets into 5 lots versus 6 lots, which I don't think is important. It says, whereas Bethany Partners agreed to loan Freshcut $750,000 in exchange for a promissory note, and it goes on about the 5 lots that, in effect, Bethany Partners had bought from Glenn. Then the next page is the thing where I want people to focus on, because this is what the trial court specifically focused on. At the top of page 3, it says, whereas Bethany Partners did transfer to Freshcut the sum of $750,000. That's exactly right. Freshcut got $750,000 in cash. The stipulation then goes on to discuss what is now going to be litigated between the receiver for Freshcut or the trustee for Freshcut. And it says on page 4, paragraph 4, the reserves parties reserve the right to assert that they are entitled to offsets at the rate of $250,000 per lot for the lots transferred in connection with any claim that may be asserted against them by the debtor.
Great. Well, let's go back to my question, which is, did Freshcut, for example, put in a bill for $1.5 million and then in return get paid by having Glenn get 6 lots? And that was supposed to wipe out the bill?
Yes.
And where is that in the record? Well, don't look now. Your time's up. But somewhere in the record we would find that.
So all those documents are in the record.
So your position is Freshcut submitted a bill for $1.5 million. Glenn got lots worth $1.5 million, therefore Freshcut was paid $1.5 million, and Crystal has to contribute 42%.
That is generally correct, although there's a little in the record is an agreement by Freshcut that it has been paid in return for those lots.
And because how much?
$1.5 million. And as I just pointed out, it in fact got $750,000 in cash. And
well, it got the cash, but it didn't theoretically, according to you, it was paid in full by the lots that it hasn't gotten either deeded to them or cash for. But it according to you, Freshcut has been paid
$750,000 in cash and their lots. And now there's a suit going on in the bankruptcy court, which is really Justice Berger's question, I think. The suit is between the trustee for Freshcut and Reserves.
All right,
Reserves loses that suit. Excuse me, just it's going to have to pay $750,000 in cash to the trustee. That's got nothing to do with Crystal Bellavia's obligation, which, as the contract says, you get a bill, you pay it. It doesn't matter whether or not Reserves paid the bill. You, Freshcut, you get a bill, you pay 42% of it. There's no contingency that says that Reserves had to pay cash to Freshcut before Crystal had to pay cash to Reserves. That's just not there. And that's why it's so illogical.
All right. Well, that's at least helpful to me, because your position, as I currently understand it, is there's an outstanding bill from Freshcut for $1.5 million. We know it's uncontested. They have $750,000. Your position, as I currently understand it, is whether we've paid the $750,000 in full and we're entitled to reimbursement for 42% is irrelevant because you owe 42%.
May I answer that, Justice Steele? Yeah.
Yes.
My time is up. That's correct.
No. You please answer Justice Holland's
question. I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
So then my question is, if your answer is predicated on you pay it because you have a bill, and we assume hypothetically Reserves hasn't paid it, this $750,000, who do you write the check for the 42% to, Reserves or Freshcut?
I think if you honor the contract, you write the check to Reserves, because then you have fulfilled your obligation. If Reserves gets sued by Freshcut, that's not your concern, because it's not a suit against you, Bellavia / Crystal. You just walk away from that. That's Reserves' problem. And, in fact, it is Reserves' problem, because they are being sued by the trustee who objected to the whole arrangement between Glenn and the bankrupt. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and assess.